Found early today as he left a party in Los Angeles. Wallace, also known as Biggie Smalls, was shot from a passing vehicle.
By shooting Saturday night, and that story tops our world headlines.
That murder of Christopher Wallace that day, notorious B.I.G., still unsolved today. So Russell Poole was the homicide investigator who initially worked the Liga Gaines shooting. And through that investigation, he learned of Gaines' connection to Suge Knight, Death Row Records. He also knew that for the relationship that Gaines had or where Gaines worked, Crash, right?
And not only that, we know that Gaines and Ray Perez were buddies and hung out at Suge Knight's parties.
Yep. Right. So Russell Poole makes a pretty strong case that murder, or that I should say that Suge Knight or Death Row Records, or at least someone at Death Row Records, was behind that murder. And some of the stuff is interesting evidence, like the armor-piercing bullets, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the FBI did a report, and it was Gecko 9mm armor-piercing ammunition that was used. Hello, folks, here on Truth Nation with, as always, Chief Mark Garrett. Chief, what's happening? You survived the hurricane. You didn't float away.
Hey, you know what? God bless those people up in North Carolina, Georgia. We got lucky here in the panhandle where I am. We really got lucky, and there was nothing going on. And so, again, thoughts and prayers to all those people who've lost loved ones, lost property, businesses, and Godspeed to all of them.
Yeah, for sure. I do have family in North Carolina, and I know it wasn't too hard on them, but there are people struggling there. And I took some heat, Mark, last week for saying that as long as we got through 45 minutes of the show, you could make it through that before you had to evacuate. Everything would be fine.
Right.
Hey, we have a special guest today. We are going to talk about an LAPD corruption scandal, and I phrase it like that for a reason. Some people call it the Rampart scandal. There are other people that call it the Ray Perez scandal, and we'll get into the reasons why that is. Our guest, who's been on the show before, Los Angeles County Assistant District Attorney Sean Carney. Sean, welcome to the show again.
Thank you, Bill. Deputy District Attorney
Attorney, right.
Those assistant U.S. attorneys sometimes get touchy about that stuff. But to let the audience know, I'm here in my personal capacity. My opinions are my own. They're not those of the office. Thank you for having me on, guys. This is a crazy case.
Yeah, it is a crazy case. And Sean was involved in it. And I know, maybe best to kind of, before we get into the details of what happened in L.A. at that time. Mark, I was in 1998, which is, the general time frame of when this thing came to light. It had been going on for a couple of years at that point. But I was not in any supervisory role at DEA yet. I was a DEA agent working in, ironically, an office that we had that was across the street from LAPD Rampart Division, over on the west side of the 110 freeway. So, very familiar with the Rampart area, and the neighborhood, and DEA did a lot of work in that neighborhood. We had a special program actually in the 90s working in that neighborhood. What were you doing then, Chief, at that time?
Well, like you, Bill, I was not in a supervisory role. I was still a real cop. I was on patrol. And actually, I was working. I'm going to let Sean kind of lay the timeline here, and Bill, for you to lead that as well. But I'll get to it when we get to it. I was really at the scene when this really broke open. I didn't know at the time. Nobody did. But we'll talk about that later on. So it's got a very close place in my memory about that time. But 1998, I was working in the afternoon shift, a swing shift on the 134 freeway, and in Burbank and Glendale, North Hollywood.
Sean, how about you?
I joined the DA's office in January of 1998. I had just come off of a job with a large law firm to do what I had a passion for, which was seeking justice. But I was a young DA. And when this thing broke open, very rare in our office, we formed an entire unit just to handle this particular investigation and prosecution. And I was recruited as one of the youngest members of the trial team on that case.
Wow. And this was the Gil Garcetti timeframe when he was the district attorney?
Yeah, it started under Gil Garcetti. I think by the time we tried our first case, he had already lost the election, and Steve Cooley came in right after the first trial.
Okay, so that kind of sets the tone of things. And so just to give a couple details on what this scandal was, it was, as I said, the 90s, there were 70 officers that were implicated in wrongdoing, primarily by really one witness or maybe a couple witnesses. And the allegations included unprovoked beatings and shootings, planting and covering up of evidence, stealing and dealing drugs, and perjury, and of course, falsifying reports. So why did I want to bring this subject up 25 years after the fact? You know, in the news now is the arrest of Sean Combs on federal charges in New York, P. Diddy. And so people remember he was the eyewitness to a murder in Los Angeles on March 9th, 1997, outside the Peterson Museum. And there are allegations from, or there were allegations from credible people, one of them being a Los Angeles Police Department detective, who we'll talk about a bit later, I'm sure, who said that that murder directly ties into the scandal that we're going to talk about. And as I said, we'll get to that later, but that's why I thought it was so timely, because that murder of Christopher Wallace that day, notorious B.I.G., still unsolved today. Whether there's some deal with Combs in the future, and, you know, not to say eyewitness he saw the actual shooter, but I'm sure he has information about what was going on behind the scenes and why Biggie was targeted. But the first thing I wanted to talk about is kind of what Crash was, right? It was something that was started originally in the 70s under a very different name, which was probably not politically correct. It was called Trash. And I don't know what the T stood for at that time. Total Resources. It was Total Resources Against Street Hoodlums. And as I said, not the most politically correct name for some policing operation. It was changed later to Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums. It was, now, Mark, let me know if I'm not getting this description of them correctly. It was a specific group that didn't really respond to radio calls, proactive policing, not traditional uniform, right? Not Class A uniform or whatever it is. And they were out there as kind of an anti-crime unit in high crime areas of the city. Rampart was one of them. So they had a crash unit, and their goal was to do proactive policing, contact people on the street, and reduce violent crime and reduce all kinds of crime, actually. Sound accurate?
Yes, very accurate. And I'm sure Sean can give more in-depth and detailed explanation of what Crash was. But from my experience with some of those guys, you know, working in the same city often as they were, you know, I think Daryl Gates's and the department's goal was to have these officers get somewhat immersed into the actual gang operations, at least through casual or maybe a little more than casual relationships with some of the members. And listen, we see this a lot anyway with standard confidential informant relationships. That's not unusual. But I think at the time, the level we're talking about here, I'm talking about the number of resources, the number of officers, and really, like you said, Bill, the freedom that they actually had to move around and conduct their investigations, their operations, without being tied to a radio or specifically to a supervisor on a regular basis, that was the difference in this case.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that's unique about LA, it's incredibly underpoliced for the geographic area and population. You compare the number of cops in LA working for LAPD to New York, the difference is vast. And so one of the things that LA under Chief Parker and subsequent chiefs, Daryl Gates, wanted to do was to really prioritize preventative policing, right? Stop the problems before they happen. Crash was a part of that. The mission of Crash, you got to remember, in particular, Rampart Crash, which we're talking about. Rampart was a division that's just west of downtown, Echo Park, Silver Lake, Pico Union, home to the 18th Street Gang, one of the most notorious and violent criminal street gangs at the time, still very active. Their mission was to proactively go after gang violence and gang crime. and to make arrests of these gang members to bring down this huge level of violence that was going on in that neighborhood. That's what Crash was all about. One of the other things that Crash had that gave it even more autonomy was they had their own office. And that sort of played a part into this scandal a little bit, which was they weren't in the division headquarters. They had their own separate offices. So they were isolated from pretty much everyone else in the department in terms of their operations, completely separate physically, as well as in their operations.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. But Sean, you bring up a good point. Like, this was 13th Street Gang and MS-13.
Or 18th Salvador. Street. But yeah.
Yeah, 18th Street Gang, but also MS-13 operating in that area heavily.
Yeah.
Alvarado, you know, Alvarado Street, et cetera.
Alvarado at 7th, Alvarado, yep. And these are the places, yeah, we all know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, you know, my recollection is that the first thing that kind of, or the first event that brought this issue to light was the shooting between two LAPD officers, which, you know, just in and of itself was very strange, right? There was, this is back in 97, March of 97, a narcotics detective named Frank Liga, who I had met. I didn't really know him well at all, but I had met him. He had a lot of expertise, if I'm remembering, in PCP yep. cases and working, you know, South LA PCP cases. He was like an encyclopedia of knowledge and understood the cooking process or the lab process of PCP manufacturing as well. He was working that day in his city car and gotten some kind of, they were doing a surveillance and the surveillance broke off or something happened. And he, at a traffic light or something, Sean, and I know you know the details of this, correct me if I'm wrong, but he encounters Gaines. Is it yep. Kevin Gaines or David? Kevin Gaines.
Kevin Gaines.
He encounters Kevin Gaines driving a Mitsubishi Montero, a green Mitsubishi Montero. And there is some, you know, visual altercation between the two of them. I don't know if they give each other dirty looks. I think I read some accounts that there were gang signs flashed, like Gaines flashed some gang signs at Liga.
Yep.
And they had words and it you know, evolved into, I guess, what was called at the time, some kind of road rage incident. And at one point they pulled over together, but Liga drove off. Now, Liga was in his, quote, police car, an unmarked car, and they have foot microphones in those cars, LAPD. So he's hitting the foot microphone. He's reporting to his surveillance team what's going on. He's saying, hey, I'm going to need some help over here. I have a guy brandishing a gun, et cetera, et cetera. The situation devolves into a shooting where Gaines pulls a gun. Liga sees the gun and shoots Gaines. Gaines manages to pull into a convenience store, but dies right in the parking lot, right? Dies in the parking lot. And then, you know, minutes later, they discover he's actually an LAPD officer. So this is one LAPD detective killing another LAPD officer. And of course, this case was, you know, evening news in LA right away. Sean, first with you, like when you heard about this, what were the first thoughts?
I mean, this case actually made national news. It was insane. You know, after this incident, I worked with Frank Liga on quite a few cases. Liga was, as you say, an outstanding narcotics detective with encyclopedic knowledge of PCP and other drug operations in L.A. This case had racial overtones from the very beginning because Liga is a white police officer working undercover. You know, Liga had a long ponytail, a Fu Manchu.
The cowboy hat, always wore a cowboy hat.
Yeah, this time he had a hat with a marijuana leaf on it because he's working undercover, right? You know, he's basically dressed up, you know, as a street hood himself. He runs into this guy in this green Mitsubishi Montero which also happened to be the color of choice for a number of blood gangsters. Turns out that's why he was driving it. Kevin Gaines, he doesn't know that Gaines is an LAPD officer. Gaines starts mad dogging him. Liga says something to him. Gaines starts mouthing off saying, I'm going to cap you. Let's pull over and settle this. So Liga very carefully, as you said, very craftily says, go ahead. And when Gaines pulls over, he takes off into traffic. Well, Liga does. Gaines goes ballistic. Chases after Liga, which is why Liga's calling out to his team to get back up. And when Gaines catches up to him, Liga's already pulled his gun because the guy's threatened to cap him. Gaines again says, I'm going to cap you, pulls his gun, and Liga shoots him. First bullet missed, went through the door. Second bullet hit Kevin Gaines in the torso, went through his heart and lodged in his lung. Gaines, basically his car pulls a U-turn and, as you say, comes to rest against the wall of his convenience store. Fascinatingly, there's two CHP officers who happen to be around the other side of the convenience store, which I'm sure Mark can add some context to. And they find the gun, by the way, that Gaines had pulled on Liga in the floor of that car, which was a really important fact because now you had an independent agency to give some corroboration to what Liga was saying.
Right. Mark, did you have any info on that back when it happened, like with those CHP guys? No.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I tell you what, Sean, you know, nailed it, of course. Not surprisingly, details are just as I remember them, including the shot into his torso. But I was about a mile away at one of my favorite restaurants. This is going to sound really, really poor for the Highway Patrol. The three of us were actually going to break at the time when this happened, myself and the other two officers. The other two CHP officers were actually work in an adjoining area. At the time, I was working the Altadena CHP area office of patrol. Adjoining that, we call it the triangle right there. There are three areas that come together. Altadena, Central Los Angeles, where Chips was filmed, and then West Valley, which is headquartered out in the San Fernando Valley. And all come together right there. Well, there's a little convenience store there. It was an AM/PM. And if you ever drove down Cahuenga Boulevard, it's right next to Universal Studios. It's at the intersection of Cahuenga and Regal. So when the CHP would take a break there or something like that, or they may be making an arrest in that parking lot, they would just tell dispatch, hey, Regal. Everyone knew what Regal was. Everybody knew. So as I said, I was on my departmentally allotted coffee break, having my first lunch of the day. And these two CHP officers put out an 1199, which is the highest call for assistance you can. And it was only two times in all my patrol time in about 15 years I heard 1199. That's how rare it is. So I drop my chopsticks literally, and I hop my Mustang. I go flying code 3 about 100 miles an hour down the street. And as I pull up to Regal, I see the scene as Sean very, very well laid it out. Gaines is actually out on the pavement at that point. He's handcuffed, and so is Liga. They're both handcuffed. The CHP officers did not know what was going on at that point. You have two people that are in civilian clothes, shots fired. By the time I pulled up, at that time they were figuring out that at least Liga was an LAPD officer. We had LAPD pulling up there. They were able to identify him. But, you know, that was my nexus. So I pulled up, and I was kind of a looky-loo. I was out of there pretty quick once I logged in, you know, walking the crime scene, and that was about it, and I was gone. But that's what we're going to get into. That's what really broke this, you know, this scandal. And I found out pretty soon about whose car was being driven. And this is what really takes us even going back to the Peterson Auto Museum murder of Biggie Smalls. It all ties in very, very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go ahead, Sean.
Yeah. I mean, bizarrely, when the police start investigating this case, Russell Poole, who we'll talk about, was one of the detectives that investigated this. You know, this case took on a lot of division with an LAPD, actually. It was very controversial. There's lots of rumors flying around. They start digging into it. They find video from the AM/PM that actually corroborates Liga's account of what happened. They start looking into Gaines. It turns out he's driving the car of Suge Knight's estranged wife, Sharitha Knight, which is bizarre. And then it turns out he's actually living with Sharitha Knight in her mansion up in the hills, because he was having a relationship with her. Kevin Gaines had styled himself essentially as a blood gang member, and he had worked for, at least as Russell Poole reports it, worked for Death Row Records security division. I think it was Wright Security. And him and several other police officers were frequent guests at parties of Suge's, including Kevin Gaines' good friend, Rafael Perez, Ray Perez, who's the center of the Rampart scandal, and another officer, David Mack, who we'll also talk about. They are all hanging out with Suge Knight a part of a group of police officers that appear to be possibly providing security at events for Suge Knight, and have deep connections to Death Row.
Yeah, and I think, Sean, also, by all accounts, they were all living beyond their means. You know, I mean, that's kind of a generic statement, but I think when Gaines was found, he had a receipt either on his person or in the car. It was like a $950 receipt from Monty's Restaurant, which was at that time a steakhouse, a pretty well-known blood hangout steakhouse in L.A.
That's right.
You know, dropping $950 on dinner, that's pricey.
He had nine credit cards with massive credit limits in his wallet at the time. Right. He was living high off the Death Row bill.
Right. And I think that opened or it caused a lot of people to question what was going on. Right. That, you know, how are these people working security? Where's this money coming from? And like I said, kind of the first glimpse that there's something strange going on with some of these officers. What else about that shooting? I mean, Liga was eventually cleared. I think there were three different LAPD investigations. And Sean, you talked about Russell Poole investigating it. Anytime there's a police use of force that results in a death, like a shooting, there is a robbery homicide investigator that's going to look at it, especially a case like this. You know, robbery homicide is their headquarters homicide investigators, extremely skilled and competent investigators. And really, he was cleared by all three different investigations, to my knowledge, right?
Yeah, that's right. Robbery homicide investigated this. Russell Poole was with robbery homicide at the time. I've had the great fortune of working with robbery homicide several times in my career. They are some of the best detectives in the country. They are definitely elite detectives. They looked at this because it's an officer involved shooting, and especially the victim was an officer also. Liga went through two Board of Rights on this mm-hmm. case. The Board of Rights is a hearing that LAPD has for discipline internally. And it's an administrative hearing where they determine whether or not they're going to fire or impose other discipline on the officer. It's a fairly formal proceeding. At the time, it was three police officers who would judge. Now there are civilians on the panel. After the first one cleared Liga, at the time, chief of police was Bernie Parks, who had formerly been head of the Internal Affairs Division. He actually ordered a second Board of Rights. Liga was cleared by the second Board of Rights. I think part of the reason why this was done like that is because of the tensions in the department between black officers and white officers, and the nationwide news coverage that this got about a white officer who rumors were flying around because of allegations by Johnny Cochran, who was suing the department, that Liga was some kind of a white supremacist and other things. And so they really dug into this hard, and Liga was cleared. The third inquiry was by my office, who reviewed it for criminal filing, and also found that the shooting appeared to be in reasonable self-defense, and cleared Liga as well, or at least did not file any charges.
Go ahead, Mark.
I'm sorry. May I ask you about that? You said there was a second Board of Rights investigation or, you know, process.
Hearing.
Yeah. Thank you. Couldn't get it out. Was there, I didn't know about that. I did not know about that. I knew he'd been cleared administratively once. I knew he'd been cleared criminally by the DA's office. Was there additional, I put that in quotes, additional information that came to light to justify a second Board of Rights hearing? Or was this simply an administrative order by the chief of police? And I want to follow, I have a follow-up question to that when you answer it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've read at least one book on the matter. I believe it was Labyrinth, which reported a lot of Russ Poole's allegations, that said the second Board of Rights was convened by Chief Parks. He wanted to make sure there was an all-black hearing board, all-black officers, because of the deep distrust that had developed within the department. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. Mm-hmm. I know at one point Chief Parks also ordered a three-dimensional reconstruction of the shooting scene before finally clearing LIGA. And I think that was even after the second Voter Rights. So to say that they went to extra steps in this case is really putting it mildly. They really went through this very, very thoroughly.
And not to get too deep in the weeds, but at the risk of doing that, the reason I ask is because in California, we have something called the Peace Officers Bill of Rights, POBR. And it seems like once you're exonerated, it's like double jeopardy in the criminal system, that you cannot be administratively interrogated a second time for the exact same allegations once you've been exonerated. So that was all new to me, and it's fresh right now to me. So that's why I was curious about. But it sounds like this was something that was done really for more than anything else, political reasons, from what we gathered.
Certainly from Russ Bull's reporting, I would say that that's true. You know, fortunately for Frank LIGA, you know, LIGA wanted to clear his name. The thing that really made LIGA angry is that when Johnny Cochran sued the city, their claims started falling apart right away. Because all this evidence had then been gathered that showed that LIGA was justified in the shooting. LIGA wanted to go to trial no matter what. The initial claim against the city, I think, was for $25 million, and I think it settled for $250,000, which is basically nuisance costs. It's nothing.
And I know LIGA was upset that they settled.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, you know, in his mind, maybe it cast some doubt, or he felt that people would have some doubt that, you know, he was justified. But, you know, Gaines also had a history. There were other, if I'm not mistaken, there were other road rage incidents. And I don't know, maybe a domestic violence thing in his history or something. Now, obviously, LIGA wouldn't have known any of that, but it goes to show the temperament of the guy and, you know, his aggressive attitude, I guess.
One of the most bizarre allegations that came forth in that investigation was that Kevin Gaines, sorry for confusing the two, Kevin Gaines, who was dating Sharitha Knight, was at a party at the mansion, went to a payphone, called 911, reported a disturbance, reported a shooting to get LAPD to respond. LAPD gets there, he's there at the mansion, and immediately he starts mouthing off to the responding officers. He starts saying things like, I hate cops, and, you know, cussing them up and down. Russ Bull believed, and other officers who heard the 911 call, that it was Gaines himself who had put in the call to trigger an LAPD response so that he could get in their face and trigger a use of force so that he could sue the department. That gives you an insight into what Kevin Gaines was like. He had numerous other road rage incidents that were documented as part of this investigation, all following similar patterns to the one he engaged in with Frank LIGA. So there was a lot of things that were going on with Gaines, who was really living a double life. One is a gang member, an associate of Death Row, and the other is a cop.
Yeah. Or I don't know, maybe just as a gang member and not even really as a cop, but yeah, that's the truth.
And he was also part of Rampart Crash.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll say this for people who know the history of Suge Knight, who know his character and know where he is now in prison for murder, the one that he got convicted of, to tempt fate by having a relationship with his estranged wife, knowing that circle, not just Suge Knight, but all of his lieutenants, the people with whom he surrounds himself, that entire culture, you're playing with nuclear weapons, not just fire. You are playing with your own life. This really, to me, it indicates the arrogance, on the part of Kevin Gaines, and going along with all the road rage incidents, things like this. I got to say this, editorialize. Quite shocking that someone like this even ended up on the department to begin with, because this character does not start somewhere 10 years into your career. This started in your early life.
Yeah. And you know, part of the, if I'm remembering it correctly, this is during the push to hire 10,000 police officers. And of course, you know, in order to do that, LAPD had to be a little flexible with their hiring standards. And there were allegations that Rampart Crash was one of the results of that.
Yeah. So was this around that hiring push? Was that around 89, 90, 88?
I think so. You had a huge crime spike in the 80s and in the 90s. I think it was Villaraigosa was really pushing to increase the department. A lot of these guys who were hired who had those backgrounds, although two of these guys, David Mack being one of them, were personally recruited by Bernie Parks into the department. And so that one is a different story. Even though David Mack grew up in the Piru Bloods neighborhood, he was actually an athlete, quite a star athlete until a leg injury. And then he was personally recruited.
So let's talk about David Mack. That brings us, you know, to later in 1997, November 1997. What's that?
October 6th.
Okay. I thought it was November. A bank robbery of a bank in downtown LA, right next to USC, right, Sean?
That's right.
Right near the USC campus.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about this bank robbery was the assistant bank manager, Errolyn Romero, had ordered much more than the normal amount of cash to be delivered to the bank that day. In other words, you know, a bank has its normal cash needs. There's a cash manager. Cash comes in, cash goes out. They obviously don't want to have a lot of cash on hand. Well, all of a sudden, there was this huge cash order put in. And literally within minutes of it arriving that day, there's a bank robbery. So investigators look at that. They become extremely suspicious of Errolyn Romero. And eventually, after a matter of a couple weeks, she cooperates and identifies David Mack, the LAPD officer that you guys were just talking about, as the bank robber, as one of the bank robbers. Now, if I'm not mistaken, just to be clear, there were two men that actually came in the bank. Sean, does that sound correct to your recollection?
Yeah, that's right. So what happened is, as you said, David Mack, who at the time was romantically involved with the bank employee, he was having an affair with her. He was married, had kids. The bank gets an unusually large order of cash. They're in the process of counting the cash back in the secure vault of the bank. When in walks this guy in a suit with a Tech 9 on a shoulder strap under his jacket, he immediately goes to the security door. He's confronted by a guard. He says, "I'm just there to check on my deposit box." He gets buzzed through and he goes to the back where they're counting this almost $800,000 in cash and robs them. Of that cash, orders the bank employees to the floor, scoops up the cash. As he's on his way out, he is confronted by a security guard who is unarmed, goes to a phone in the bank to try and phone it in to the police. And as that guard is on the phone, another individual who is in the bank, not Mac, puts a gun to his head and says, "Don't do that." And of course, he doesn't. So there's at least two guys in the bank, and then there was a third individual who was the getaway driver. They used a stolen white van, and that van was later found. It had been cleaned up, and those other two suspects were never found. But it was long suspected that at least one of them was Ray Perez because he was good friends with David Mack.
Yeah, and I think they did have evidence that the weekend after this robbery, David Mack, Ray Perez, and a third person who I don't recall his name, who was also LAPD, went to Las Vegas, spent the weekend in Vegas, gambled large amounts of cash. So, you know, there would be some and also in some statements that Perez later made spontaneously that kind of point to the fact that he may have been involved in this bank robbery. Mark, do you remember anything else about that bank robbery or any other parts of that were interesting to you at the time?
No, that's really as much as I remember about the incident. You know, having worked as head of corporate security for a bank after I left the Highway Patrol for 2.5 years, it really you know, hit home with me about bank security and these procedures and the assistant bank manager being involved in this conspiracy to do it, because often this has to happen for things to go down this cleanly. But as far as the event itself and recollection, this is as much as I remember about it, what you're talking about today.
Yeah. Yeah, Bill, you're absolutely right about the spree in Vegas afterwards. You know, when David Mack had like $7,000 in cash at home, he had just bought a new car, him, Ray Perez, and this third officer Mac and Perez had been partners in narcotics. The third officer was the officer that sponsored him into Rampart Crash. And they're out in Vegas partying it up, gambling thousands and thousands of dollars. They were in a $1,500 a night hotel suite. This was the weekend that was after the bank robbery. That was during that week, like 2 days later.
Right.
Yeah.
Can we say not a coincidence?
And yeah, nobody ever found the money. That's ever. Right. We looked. No. I mean, at some point, I think we had investigators digging up a pool that David Mack had put in, thinking that the money was buried underneath the pool. We never found the money. Nobody ever found the money. David Mack never gave up his co-conspirators. And Ray Perez, although clearly implicated and good friends with Mack, denied any involvement. You know, the reason Ray Perez was friends with Mack is because when they were in narcotics, they were approached by a narcotics dealer. They were working undercover. According to Perez and Mack, that narcotics dealer pulled a gun on them, asked them if they were Bloods or Crips. Perez was just saying, "Hey, man, I'm just a crackhead. Don't mess with me." And David Mack shot that guy about 15 times, I think it was, altogether. You know, David Mack actually won LAPD's second highest award for that shooting. Based largely on the account given by Ray Perez, who said that Mack saved his life. Given all the lies that Perez told later about shootings and planting guns on people, there was a couple of witnesses who came forward to say that didn't happen that way.
It was refuted by other witnesses. The story that Ray Perez told was refuted by other witnesses. But I think you were correct in identifying that as a key point that really forged the relationship between Mack and Perez, you know, where there was almost unquestionable trust between the two of them.
Exactly.
And probably, like you said, why one didn't give up the other one later on.
That's exactly right. So assuming there was some truth to it, and it's not even clear that story by Perez is true because he told so many lies, it's hard to sort them out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So what do you guys think? What's the next key point in this? I mean, I know there was some...
The next key to this is Ray Perez, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because an interesting thing happened. So David Mack eventually gets arrested, and he goes down on a federal case for 14 years. Mm-hmm. He's done. Ray Perez comes under investigation later on independently because it turns out that Ray Perez was stealing cocaine from the evidence lockers and having a confidential informant of his, a gang contact, a woman actually, sell it on the streets for him and make money. And it turns out that Perez was in the habit of doing this often. It finally came up. There was a property audit. The officer whose name was down on the log as having checked out the 6 pounds of cocaine said, "I never checked out that cocaine." And one of the property managers that was in the property room that day happened to remember at least enough details, and partly because she said Ray Perez was an asshole. And she remembered him because he was arrogant and condescending and just an asshole. And she remembered enough details for the officers to put together that it was Ray Perez who had taken that cocaine, had never returned it because he'd sold it on the streets. That starts the investigation of Ray Perez. Interestingly, a little while later, Perez steals another pound of cocaine. This time it was cocaine that had been booked in by Frank Liga, the guy who shot Ray Perez's friend, Kevin Gaines. And it was widely believed that Ray Perez was trying to set Liga up for the theft of the cocaine. That didn't work either. Ray Perez eventually gets busted. When they serve a search warrant on Ray, the officers who are investigating approach him. And the first thing that Ray Perez says is this about the bank robbery? It wasn't anything to do with the bank robbery. It was about him stealing kilos of cocaine and selling it on the street. But his first response was the bank robbery. Ray Perez is eventually charged by my office. Richard Rosenthal is the DA that was in charge of that case. It goes to trial. The jury hangs 8-4 in favor of guilt. Set for a retrial, and the DA's office, as we often do when we hang one the first time, looks for more. We find 11 more incidents where Ray Perez had checked out cocaine and replaced it with Bisquick.
Now, Sean, did they just then decide, hey, we better do an audit of the exhibits in this lab, in this storage facility, and see if the drugs have been tampered with? Is that how that came to be known?
Yeah, because we knew that there was probably a pattern there. The problem was, is LAPD's standards, especially if it was under a pound of narcotics, standards for handling that stuff was really, really lax. I mean, you could just call them up and say, hey, I'm Officer So-and-so, send this cocaine out for court to this division. And then they'd pick it up, and that's it. And so they started looking into it. Yeah, they find 11 more transactions where he had swapped dope with Bisquick, cocaine with Bisquick.
So the initial case that hung, the 8-4 jury.
Yeah.
Do you have a feeling for why it ended like that? Like, was it just the public's not wanting to believe that a cop was corrupt, or what was it?
Yeah. There's two things in this case. One is it's incredibly difficult to prosecute police officers anywhere. That's still true, frankly. Even recently, I've seen cases in our office where it's very difficult. I think there is some belief, and rightfully most of the time, that police officers are generally doing a very difficult job, doing the best they can to do it. Ray Perez wasn't one of them. Mm-hmm. Ray Perez, I think, also had going for him that he was an absolute charmer. He was a good looking guy. He was one of those detectives that came in. He knew everything about the case. He was testified with confidence, with detail. He had read the reports. He was familiar with the case. From a DA's perspective, he was one of the detectives you hope was coming in on one of your cases, because he would be believed by a jury. And in fact, one of his testimonies, we'll talk about this case, was about a shooting by him and his partner of a guy named Ovando. The jury convicted Ovando, and he was sentenced to 23 years for a shooting that was completely made up by Ray Perez.
Right.
That's how convincing Ray Perez was. He was a master perjurer.
And just to highlight two points that we talked about here in the past 5 minutes, because I think they are key to this case. The first being that when he's approached on this, I think they call him in the captain's office at the station, or the captain's talking to him, and the first thing he says is this about the bank robbery? So, you know, I don't know if he's thinking, did Mac cooperate finally, or am I going to go down for some, but, you know, imagine that. That's the first response. Not what is this about or what's going on here. It's, is this about the bank robbery?
Which crime and am I being interrogated about?
Right. The second thing is the theft of the pound of cocaine or whatever it was that was booked in by Frank Liga. Yeah. And the attempt to, you know, if that ever came to light, hey, who better to pin it on than Frank Liga, who killed your friend, right?
That's right.
And I think those are key pieces there.
They absolutely are. Sean, if I may, Bill, you hit on something that I think it's a great question about the hung jury, Sean, those four. Now, my understanding, I mean, I read, you know, this is years ago, I read accounts of citizens who lived in areas that were served by crash. And many, many residents of those areas raved about the job that crash did. They were so grateful they were there. They said the crime dropped. They felt safe to walk the street. They felt safe letting their kid walk to school again. They raved about crash. Do you happen to know if any of those four in the jury were aware that Perez was part of crash, or if that had any influence, or there were people that were favorable to the crash unit?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't involved directly in that first case, because that was before the task force was formed. So I'm not sure about the demographics of the four. But that wouldn't be surprising, frankly, because I'm sure it came out. One of the first questions we ask an officer on the stand is, you know, what is your occupation and assignment? Now, in the prosecution of Perez, we wouldn't, but I'm sure his counsel would have gotten that out, that he was a Rampart crash officer. And you're right. A lot of people from that community, you know, who had been victimized over and over again by street gangs, certainly appreciated the efforts to make that neighborhood safer for them, especially vendors and others who are being extorted constantly, mob style, by gangsters to just, you know, sell things on the street, sell fruit on the streets, food vendors, whatever. If there was business in Rampart, the gangs were taxing it. And then they were killing people left and right over disputes. And so, yeah, I'm sure the community was fed up with it. But I don't know if those four were part of that.
And I know the motto, so to speak, and I don't know if this was internal or if it was external, was for Crash, was intimidating those who intimidate others.
Yeah, that's correct. I think it was in their office. I think it was in the station for the Crash office. And that was their motto. And frankly, you know, as Ray Perez said during his debriefs, and we debriefed him, I can't remember how many days. It was so many. There was 4,000 pages of transcripts because all of his debriefs were done under oath and they were transcribed by a reporter. And Ray Perez said, basically, you know, we had one mandate, which was get gangbangers off the street, bring down the crime rate. And they weren't going to play by the rules. So we weren't going to play by the rules. And so if we had to cut corners, if we had to put cases on people, that's fine. That's what we were going to do.
Can we talk about that Ovando case?
Yeah. So that was a case that happened October 12th, 1996. You know, Ray Perez had only been in Crash for 1 year at that point. We didn't find out about this until we debriefed Perez after he had pled. So if I didn't mention it before his second trial, Ray Perez entered a guilty plea and agreed to fully cooperate with prosecutors. He was given immunity for everything except for any murders.
Sean, let me jump in there. So the first case against Perez, 8-4, hung jury. The DA's office in LAPD goes back, gets more evidence that more drugs were tampered with, more drugs were stolen and sold on the streets by this guy. They file a second case, and then with that, in the face of that overwhelming evidence, he decides to plead guilty and cut a deal.
That's exactly right. And part of that deal is cooperate. And that is what led to what was really known as the Rampart corruption scandal, because that was based in large part on the huge Pandora's box that was opened by Ray Perez during those debriefs. So one of the cases he told us about, and one of the cases that we did get a conviction in, was him and his partner, Nino Durden, were working what they call an observation point. So they're in an abandoned building. They're in an apartment. They are using that as a vantage point to observe drug dealing so that they can make some busts of some of the gangbangers that are dealing drugs. A guy named Ovando, who he says happened to be squatting in one of the nearby apartments, says they burst in on him. They roughed him up. And eventually, what definitely happened is that one of them, our theory of the case was Nino Durden, shot Ovando in the head. Ovando miraculously survives. There was, according to the accounts that I saw, brain matter on the wall when he was shot in the head, and somehow he survives the shooting. Ray Perez tells us that shooting was completely dirty. And in fact, you know, we had said in our reports that he had burst in on us and tried to assault us with an assault weapon. In fact, we were just rousting him for information. We were pissed off that he was in our OP, our observation point, and we just blew him away. And after they did that, they put what's called a throwdown gun on him, which Ray Perez said most of the cops in Crash carried guns that they had either recovered on the streets or had obtained by other means that they could plant on suspects so they could say the suspect was armed at the time a shooting occurred, to providing them with a defense to say it was a legitimate shooting. Ray Perez said they planted that assault rifle on him, and we were able actually to later track that gun. The serial number had been partially erased, but we were able to bring it back up and track that gun to a bust that had been made earlier by Perez and Durden. So that gun definitely did not get there through Ovando. It got there through Ray Perez. That case was really an eye-opener. I mean, when Ray Perez told us of that case and told us that you know, the corruption was very widespread in Crash, then we knew we had just a huge mess on our hands. And Nino Durden actually ended up getting convicted of that case. He spent several years in custody. I think he was also convicted on the federal side on that case. And he also went down for shooting Ovando. Strangely enough, Ovando sued the city, won at the time, I think, was one of the largest awards against the city of Los Angeles. It was $15 million.
Right.
And I think within a month was on his way to Vegas with a bunch of blow. and gets busted for cocaine trafficking.
Yep, he did. He got busted for cocaine trafficking in Nevada. And but, you know, I think what we didn't mention, Sean, is he was paralyzed in that shooting. Yeah. Was he not? He was in a wheelchair.
He was. Yeah, he was. And so the bizarre thing was that during the criminal trial of Ovando, because our office filed a case against Ovando for assaulting two police officers, he was at that trial in a wheelchair. And as I said before, Ray Perez, who is amazingly charismatic and a great witness, convinced the jury that he was guilty. In fact, the defense attorney, who was a public defender, who I know personally, has said since then she even believed Ray Perez during that trial. He was such a tough witness to cross-examine, according to her. She wasn't surprised at the verdict, and it turns out later that the whole thing was absolutely made up.
Yeah. And what did he do? He did 2 years. He ended up doing 2 years before he was released.
Yeah, 2 years out of a 23-year sentence before he was finally released. That was one of the first things our office did when Ray Perez told us that. First thing we did was file what's called a writ of habeas corpus. That is rarely filed by prosecutors. It's usually something defense attorneys file to say, hey, my client's rights were violated. We did that right away because you can't have somebody in prison when you have evidence like that, that he's innocent.
Right.
Yeah. Jeez.
So Ray Perez is debriefed for months after that and starts to lay out what he says is rampant corruption throughout the Rampart crash unit. He says that it is routine for officers in Rampart crash to beat suspects, to plant drugs on them, to plant cases on them. There's so many bizarre allegations made by Perez. He alleged incidents where he said he was present, where officers took a gang member, hung him by the heels over a balcony on a multi-story building to get him to give up information on the gang. One of the things that's bizarre about that is that's also an allegation against Suge Knight.
Right.
That Suge Knight took a business, someone that was in business with him, and hung him over a balcony. I mean, the parallels are bizarre. And we know Ray Perez hung out at some parties with Suge Knight, according to Russ Poole. So I don't know. Is that true? Is it not? You know, we were never able to corroborate it. And that was one of the problems with Ray Perez. Ray Perez is a liar. And all day long, he's a perjurer. He is toxic to a prosecution. We certainly want to hear what he has to say because he's giving us a lot of things that, at least in some cases, we're able to corroborate. But he's toxic as a witness because he's a proven perjurer.
Yeah. So let's talk about a couple of the officers that he provided information on or he, quote, gave up. Edward Ortiz, Brian Liddy, Paul Harper, and Michael Buchanan. Yeah. And that's, to me, that's an interesting case because of the prosecution of those four, because of what, and I'm curious to hear if this is accurate or not, but I've seen stories told that charges were filed 3 days before the statute expired and that there was tremendous pressure from the mayor's or from the chief of police to file charges. Talk about that case and what the allegations were and what eventually happened with these officers.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that was bizarre about this case, and especially as a young prosecutor on this trial team, is, you know, we have a relationship of trust with our investigators, right? It is fundamental to what we do. And in this case, we're working with LAPD and we're working with our own DA investigators developing this case. At one point, Chief Parks directs our investigators not to share any more information with us publicly. I remember finding out about that and just being completely shocked. It's like, how can you cut us out of this investigation? And his excuse was, well, the feds are investigating, so we're going to give everything to them.
Sean, let me interrupt there. So he told the LAPD investigators not to share any more information with the DA's office.
That's right. They cut us off completely. Yep. And of course, it resulted in a huge scandal. And the police commission ordered him to reverse his position, and he did. But only after Gil Garcetti had to go out, who was the district attorney at the time, go out publicly and accuse Chief Parks of obstruction of justice. So it was a huge deal that LAPD was basically trying to freeze us out of this investigation. The other thing that happened during this case, we prepared our first round of search warrants, and I believe it was on Ortiz and Liddy and Harper and Buchanan. We're working with internal affairs at LAPD and our own investigators. By the time they go out at early in the morning to serve those search warrants, all of those targets have been tipped that we were coming. That tells you that there's a fundamental break in that trust relationship between us and our investigators. I don't know if it's them or their chain of command or somebody else, you know, that somehow was in the know. But given that all these guys are armed, because they're obviously police officers, they're targets of criminal investigations, to tip them off a search warrant is coming, not just, you know, extreme obstruction of justice, but puts our investigators at risk, right?
Yeah.
But they all knew. And I remember finding out when our investigators came back, finding out that these guys all knew the warrants were coming and thinking to myself, damn, like we have to do this by ourselves. We can't trust anyone from LAPD in this case. That was something that really made this case very difficult. So, you know, was there a push by the chief of police? In some respects, yeah, because he wanted to have a one and done, right? He wanted to, let's nail somebody, let's get this case past us, and let's move on, right? Mm-hmm. And so did our office cave into that pressure? Not from my point of view, because frankly, part of the problem is that our investigation was being undercut by the very people who were supposed to be helping us make the investigation.
Go ahead, Mark.
This is, in fact, I'm sure the audience heard me knock my microphone over a minute ago. You got to be kidding me. I did not know that happened, Sean. I don't recall it. Maybe it's my feeble elderly
mind
here.
Wasn't really publicly reported, honestly.
It wasn't. And there's two aspects of this. First of all, the chief getting involved in between his investigators, criminal investigators, working with the DA's office. And for people, you're the expert in this, but you know, from my point of view, that look, the part of the job of the DA's office is to investigate with or in parallel, but certainly going down the road of investigation, fact finding. That's their job. And a lot of your resources come from law enforcement agencies, whether it's LAPD or Highway Patrol, whoever it is. Now, that's part one. Part two is anybody that wants to impede that relationship or impede an investigation. That is a problem. I'm just going to leave that alone right there. But 2A, the second part is when he goes public, and I didn't know this. He said he publicly said that he was not going to allow his investigators to provide the DA's office anymore. That is an outward political statement. And what you said a minute ago about, hey, one and done with Perez, okay, we got it solved. So here's my take on this. And this goes back to that hiring push back in the late 1980s. If you start uncovering a systemic pattern of behavior, and they're all coming from the same time frame as far as hiring, this is a reflection on LAPD, not the individual officer, so to speak. Certainly they're responsible for their action, but this really reveals a philosophy and a pattern of behavior that the department's responsible for, that they are the genesis of this problem. So that's why I said, you got to be kidding me. Why would you do such a thing? Go public and say, we're not going to let them investigate. Any 5-year-old could figure out, well, because you don't want the department to be exposed.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, this case had far-reaching political implications, which we can talk about at the end if you want. And part of it was that Parks lost his job.
Yeah. Well, you know me, I hate politics, so not me. Yeah.
And Mark, you know, to your point, Mark, I don't know if you know this, but Russell Poole, the homicide detective who we spoke of earlier, the robbery-homicide detective, he actually filed a suit against LAPD alleging many of these things that we're talking about now, that Parks tried to cover it up, that there was information that he was basically told not to continue to investigate, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll get into that, I'm sure, when we talk about the 1997 murder of Chris Wallace, right?
Yeah.
Good.
But back to Ortiz, Liddy, Harper, and Buchanan, Sean, they were charged with what? Perjury, falsifying reports. I assume the kind of stuff that Perez was saying was widespread.
That's correct. So they were charged, yes, with those kinds of charges. There was three different incidents that we had charged that went to trial in front of Judge Jackie Connor. The jury found them not guilty on two of the incidents. They found the three of the defendants guilty on one incident. This was something that we called the Alley incident. It was an incident where Ray Perez had arranged, essentially he had learned of a gang meeting he had arranged for Rampart Crash to swoop down on this gang meeting and detain these gang members. There was an allegation that two of the members got into a truck, drove down this alley, and supposedly had clipped two of the officers on their way down the alley. Ray Perez had told us it never happened. That way that they were never hit and that the officers filed a false police report so that they could arrest these two gang members and prosecute them. We went to trial on that case because we had developed some independent witnesses that corroborated what we had learned through Perez. Interestingly, we never called Perez during the trial because Perez is a lying liar who lies. and so... you know, any defense attorney would have had a field day for days impeaching Ray Perez with all the perjury he had committed and all the people he had sent to prison for things they didn't do. You can't put a guy like that on the stand. The jury ended up convicting on that one incident, on this alley incident. One of the interesting things that happened in that case was that afterwards, fairly typical in these cases, there's a motion for new trial by the defense. The defense essentially said, well, you know, some of the jurors in this case misunderstood the jury instructions about great bodily injury. They believed that as long as the officers had not suffered great bodily injury, that they could convict them of filing a false police report. And the judge said, no, that's not what the instructions were intended to say. It was that whether or not they falsely reported an assault likely to cause great bodily injury. And the judge overturned the verdict set it back for a new trial. So that basically puts the case back at square one. Mm-hmm. Unlike a motion like that that's made before it goes to the jury, once we have a guilty verdict and the judge overturns it like that, we can appeal. And the DA's office did appeal, and that appeal languished for several years, eventually was upheld. So that motion for new trial was upheld on appeal. The Supreme Court declined review, came back to our office years later. And at that point, the few witnesses we had in that case that corroborated what Perez said were no longer available. They were some of them were incarcerated, had issues of their own. Our office did not go forward on a retrial.
And those officers ended up suing the city of Los Angeles, if I remember right, and got and won, right? And got large sure settlements, right? The three that were convicted.
That's right. They sure did. So they sued in federal court. After several years of litigation, the jury awarded each of them $5 million. They ended up added to the already enormous stack of litigation liability the city had racked up for all the cases that Ray Perez had put on people. I think the city ended up paying out well over $125 million for some of that stuff. And then they added to it 15 more million for the police officers who went to trial and whose verdicts were overturned.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Sean, what was the fallout of the whole thing as far as cases that were impacted? In other words, I guess two sides of that, right? First is cases against police officers, whether they're administrative or criminal. And the second part of that is previous criminal cases that had to be reviewed where some type of action was taken, the charges were, you know, there was an order to set them free or whatever. You know, what's that right. called and
was corpus.
That done? Yeah.
Yeah, that was done. Unusually in this case, we had to set up three units within our Rampart Task Force. One unit was dedicated solely to undoing cases that Ray Perez told us were dirty, because whether or not we can prosecute anybody for those cases, you can't let those convictions stand. There was well over 100 cases that were overturned that we filed habeas corpus petitions from the DA's office to overturn those convictions because of what Ray Perez had told us about those cases. Administratively, LAPD, I think, initiated proceedings against 70 police officers based on Ray Perez's debriefs. 24 were only disciplined. Of those, 12 were suspended, 7 resigned, 5 were fired. In the criminal case, I think we brought charges against 8 officers. Of course, we got verdicts that were overturned on 3 of them. The 4th in that trial was acquitted. The rest of the officers actually pled. Nino Durden pled. Ethan Cohen pled for beating up a gang member. And his partner pled and cooperated. So those convictions happened. Ray Perez himself only got 5 years on the state side because that was the deal that was made for the cocaine charges in his cooperation. He ended up, after serving his state time, charged by the feds. I think he got another 2 years on the fed side and then was released. The political fallout of this case was absolutely immense. You want me to go into that?
Well, let's talk about the murder of Christopher Wallace first and Russell Poole, right? So Russell Poole was the homicide investigator who initially worked the Liga Gaines shooting. And through that investigation, he learned of Gaines' connection to Suge Knight, Death Row Records. He also knew that, you know, the relationship that Gaines had or where Gaines worked, Crash, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, and not only that, you know, we know that Gaines and Ray Perez were buddies and hung out at Suge Knight's parties.
Yep. Right. So Russell Poole makes a pretty strong case that murder was, I should say that Suge Knight or Death Row Records, or at least someone at Death Row Records, was behind that murder. And some of the stuff it's interesting evidence, like the armor piercing bullets, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess the FBI did a report and it was Gecko 9mm armor piercing ammunition that was used.
Very unusual. Manufacturer.
Yep. And so I think it could only be found at a couple distributors in the whole United States.
Yep.
The very same ammo was found in David Mack's house.
Yeah.
Right. The other thing that was in David Mack's house, if I'm not mistaken, it was a black Chevy Impala SS.
That's right.
Which, by all witness accounts, that was the car that was used by the shooter outside the Peterson Museum.
That's right.
And like I said, Russell Poole filed a lawsuit against LAPD, you know, claiming that there was basically a cover-up. What can we add to that? Or where does the truth lie in that?
I don't know that we're ever going to know the truth of that one.
Right.
You know, one interesting detail you can add to that Impala was that in that garage or in another room in the house, he had a shrine to Tupac, right? Mm-hmm. Who at the time was aligned with Suge Knight, was one of Suge's biggest producers. Suge had been killed. I'm sorry, not Suge. Tupac had been killed in Las Vegas. There was a lot of this East Coast, West Coast gangster rap rivalries between Sean Puffy Combs and his Bad Boy Records and Suge Knight and his Death Row Records, right? So there's lots of theories out there as to who killed who and why. With respect to the Biggie Smalls or Notorious B.I.G. With his killing, you know, one of the things that Russell Poole noticed is that there was 2 cars involved, right? One was that black Impala that's related to Mac. And the other one is that the way it was pulled off seemed to be really professional. There was one car that was used to cut off the trail cars, which had security. Another car, the black Impala, then pulls up next to it. And blasts Biggie and kills him ultimately. And they managed to get away very quickly. And this is at a time where a bunch of people are coming out of the Peterson Museum and there's lots of traffic going on. And there's hundreds and hundreds of witnesses and yet nobody seems to have seen anything.
Yeah.
Right. And part of it is that Suge Knight was widely suspected to be behind this. And everyone was terrified of Suge Knight. And frankly, Suge Knight had a bunch of LAPD officers working for him.
Yep. And, you know, the background on the murder of Tupac, if I remember the story, you know, that murder, I think, happened in September. Am I right with that?
Of Tupac in Las Vegas?
Yeah. September of what year, Mark? Was it also 97?
I thought it was 90, earlier than that. I could be wrong. I thought it was 96, but it could be 97.
Maybe you're right. Whatever the case, just prior to that, there was a young man named Trayvon Lane, and he was at the Lakewood Mall in California, and he either, if I'm remembering the story, he either had worked or was working for Death Row Records. And they had a big Death Row Records medallion that many of the employees had. And the story goes that the Southside Crips had put a bounty on this medallion. If anyone could get that medallion, they'd pay money for it or whatever the case. It was kind of just a valuable, a prize, right? A prize to have some property from this other gang. So Orlando Anderson, the story goes, confronted Lane at that mall that day, the Lakewood Mall. I'm not sure if he successfully stole that medallion from him or there was an attempt to steal a medallion and Lane got away. But whatever, the Bloods knew who had done this. You know, Lane told his gang members, his fellow gang members, who had done this. Suge Knight and Tupac encountered Orlando Anderson in the MGM Hotel in Las Vegas that night.
At the time,
they recognized this as the guy who tried to steal the Death Row medallion. They beat him up there, and then that leads to his Orlando Anderson's uncle, Keefe D. Dwayne Davis, was it? Or
yeah, I don't remember his name.
Keefe D. And him putting this plan together to kill Tupac, and now Davis is charged. Right, Keefe D. is now charged in Nevada with that, with
that's
the
right.
murder. That's right. Yeah.
That's right. That case is now pending, which is
right. So that's kind of the backstory of at least that part of it. Now there's some talk that, well, you know, when Combs was in LA, some Crips used to do security for him. I don't know. I don't know if that whole retaliatory thing with Christopher Wallace was just Tupac got killed and now we're going to kill a big East Coast artist, part of the East Coast, West Coast thing. I don't know, but the first part of it was really definitely gang related. And man, both you guys, how many, I used to see the shooting reports from like the Figueroa corridor in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
95% of them started with this statement. Where are you from?
Yeah.
That's right.
That's the first statement. And it was all that area is gang related shootings. And really there doesn't have to be a whole lot of other personal relationship with these people. If they're from a different gang and there's some animosity with that gang. And that might have been what that Christopher Wallace murder was all about. Someone from the Blood side got killed and they were going to go after someone from the East Coast side just for revenge as being part of that whole other whole other family, so to speak.
Yeah, there's a lot of theories that are out there, which is why I say it's really hard to get to the bottom of it, because there is even a theory that Suge Knight arranged the hit on Tupac because Tupac was going to leave the label, and if Tupac died, he'd maintain rights. Right? There's all kinds of things which throws into confusion whether or not the killing of Biggie was really retaliation for Tupac's killing. There's a theory that I've seen, I think in one of Russ Poole's statements, that the actual target was Sean Puffy Combs, who was in the car behind.
Right.
And Biggie just happened to be the one that got it. There's lots of these theories that are going around in terms of what the motives were. And yeah, it's one of the simplest motives is that it's just, gang rivalry or, it's retaliation.
And the only thing, I'm sorry, Mark, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say the only thing I've heard that theory on, Suge Knight set it up. Don't forget, he got shot also though.
Yeah.
He got shot also. He survived it. Yeah. But that's a risky proposition there to set someone up shooting into your car when you're in the car.
I agree. That doesn't seem like a realistic theory. Now, he didn't actually take it doesn't appear he took a bullet. It looks like he got glass fragments or bullet fragments in the head. It was a graze wound. But all the same, I don't know anybody who would set up an assassination when they're in the car next to the target.
especially when you're the size of Suge Knight, a former NFL defensive lineman. You take up half the car. So you're a big target. But, Bill, I looked it up real quick, and it was September of 96 that Tupac was killed. So, you know, plenty of time for things to brew.
Yep.
But we're talking about motives. So like you said, we'll never get to the actual factual bottom of this, but some theories are more likely than others. Retaliation just seems to be the most likely, because retaliation was a culture. We're talking about these gang wars in Los Angeles, wherever they are. Retaliation's very, very common motive, obviously money being right there with it. But and you guys talked about the professionalism of this hit in Los Angeles at the Peters Auto Museum, which I know very, very well inside out. I spend a lot of time at the Peters Auto Museum, and they're the intersection of Wilshire and Fairfax, depending on the time of day, an extremely congested area. And like you said, cutting off the tail vehicle with protection there and traffic control and having availability, line of sight, there are some professionals involved. There are people who knew what they were doing. They probably had good communication. And that all ties into these people that were doing security for Suge Knight. These are cops that were doing security for him. Look, if it smells like a duck, walks like a duck, it probably is a duck. Anything's possible. But that's what it looks like, retaliation. I want to say something else about that with, and this is maybe a little bit off, but I want to get to the fallout. Mm-hmm. Bill, like you're talking about.
Yeah.
But this is part of the fallout. This is part of why LAPD ended up under this consent decree. And you think about, and again, look, I think you both know, I mean, my best friend in the world is LAPD currently. I got a lot of friends in LAPD. I love LAPD because I work so closely with them. But at the same time, we have to be honest. You know, the policies with LAPD when it relates to off-duty work or secondary employment, that is something that is really, really telling about how we got to where we are. Allowing people to do security off-duty with their weapons, things like this. Now, by the way, most agencies do. Most agencies I'm aware of allow their officers off duty. You put a form in, here's what I'm doing to provide security with their weapons, things like this. Highway Patrol does not allow that. It doesn't mean you can't carry your weapon off duty. It doesn't mean you can't carry your weapon in a secondary employment position, but your weapon cannot be required as part of your secondary employment. So a little bit of gray area there, but what it does is it really separates the department from any liability, number one. I think more importantly, it separates the officer from being a cop when they're off duty and engaging in behavior they may not otherwise engage in. I don't think that same culture has applied to LAPD. And of course, it opens everybody up to the things we're talking about today.
Yeah.
Now that was a big part of the problem is LAPD didn't look very deeply into. They gave an officer, at least in one instance, a permit to work for the security company that was related to Death Row Records. He was working the front desk at one of Desk Row's studios, and eventually was ordered not to. But the fact that that went through their permit check process and they said, "Yep, that's fine," and approved it is bizarre when Death Row was under active investigation from LAPD and they approved one of their officers working there. It shows you exactly what you said, Mark, that they weren't digging hard to see whether or not it was in the interest of the department.
Yeah. I mean, can we say conflict of interest? I mean, Bill, and please don't forget what you're going to say, but these are rudimentary, elementary things when it comes to leadership, when it comes to management, when it comes to public trust. These are fundamental, foundational things about what does this look like? What does it appear to the public if we're allowing one of our officers to work in a security role with an organization whom we are investigating for criminal behavior? It's really bizarre to me. And you laid it out very well, Sean. Bill, I'm sorry, go right ahead.
No, I was just going to say the political fallout. I mean, that's really what was left. I know probably the mayor was out because of this. For sure, yeah. Chief Parks didn't have his contract renewed.
That's right.
Right?
The LA Police Commission voted 4-1 against renewing Parks' contract. That was largely after Jim Hahn, who was the mayor at the time, had came out and said he wanted somebody else. once Parks was gone, the community in South LA was very upset. At least there's a theory that Jim Hahn lost his reelection because he lost all that support over this thing. The LAPD, which had survived the 1992 Rodney King beating and the drubbing they got in the O.J. Simpson case and the riots after the Rodney King beating, without having a federal consent decree, finally, after this investigation, actually succumbs over Park's objection, actually, but the city council essentially voted in favor of it, so he had no choice.
And Sean, real quick, explain what that means, a consent decree.
Yeah, so the federal government will investigate police departments for what they call pattern and practice investigations, which is to investigate whether the department as a whole is engaging in patterns or practices of enforcement that are designed to violate the civil rights of the citizens of the community. And LAPD had long been under investigation for pattern and practice, but had resisted and successfully resisted having a consent decree imposed. And after Rampart crash, the federal government basically said, if you don't agree to a consent decree, we're going to file suit against you for pattern and practice, and then everything's going to come out in court, and we're going to lay it all out, and we'll win a consent decree anyway. And so finally, with the consent of the LA City Council, the department agreed and signed off. And so that basically means that there is a federal monitor who is monitoring police practices in LAPD for many years after that, who is monitoring their policies and their training to make sure that they are implementing reforms, to make sure that violations of civil rights don't occur, and that the department engages in practices in hiring and training and deployment and other things that don't result in civil rights violations. That was a huge shift in LAPD culture.
Yeah. Mark, anything else on this one?
Look, Bill, you know me and my philosophical rantings and things like that. I just couldn't agree more that LAPD put themselves obviously in position. This was a complete lack of leadership. By the way, you know, ironically, going back to Daryl Gates, who was lambasted for his statements, and I think stupid statements he made during the Rodney King incident. But ironically, Daryl Gates had created this unit that really did, that the intention was to relieve and alleviate so many citizens of the city of Los Angeles from this rampant gang crime. That was what it was intended to do. It was not intended to violate civil rights. It wasn't intended to obviously commit crimes against suspects or non-suspects. It was intended to help the people that he and his department served. But as we progress down the road here, we see other people who have ancillary motivations about hiring push, and we're going to get maybe a certain demographic in the department as quickly as we can. And then, of course, it leads to, I think, people, and you really laid it out, Sean, earlier, people who should not have been police officers, should not have been police officers. And you also talked about one of those, at least one of those applicants who had been recommended, I believe, by Chief Parks. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was David. I believe David, it was David Mack. Yeah,
David Mack. That's right. Athlete.
Mark, have you ever competed against him in athletics? Did you recall?
No, I'm still alive, obviously, so I haven't.
He was an 800 meter track guy.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, I meant that in a complimentary way that he would have killed me in athletics.
Oh, got it.
No. But what I was saying is that just because you have a chief that's recommending somebody, I'm telling you right now, I think we all know it. It doesn't matter your rank in an organization. People can still have, let's say, impure motives, or they can turn a blind eye when their motivations are so intense about another objective, they can fall short of maybe their own good standards. They can disregard those sometimes because they have other motivations. And they may be good motivations, they may be good intentions, but we have to be careful as leaders that we don't let other priorities really offset or dispel the more important priorities about public trust. And just because it was Bernie Parks, we can see that he, the chief, recommended this guy who turns out at the very, very least of being a bank robber and probably a murderer. So all of this can fall short. We have to be careful about this. We see what it led to with the consent decree. We see what it led to as far as liability. We see what it led to as far as public trust. So I want to say this. I don't think it was the crash unit. I think like so many other organizations, it was the individuals who were taking part in this that brought the system down, so to speak, and brought us to where we are today. And by the way, fortunately, LAPD is certainly to some, I think, substantial degree, degree recovered from this. But man, what a blemish over otherwise great, you know, history.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, having worked with LAPD extensively over the years, they absolutely came out the better after this. I've worked with many, many great LAPD officers and detectives from street level to rampart to robbery homicide. And they are a different organization than what was reflected in Rampart Crash, for sure. Here's an interesting little side note as to what you just said, Mark. At one point, Ray Perez actually applied to another department before this scandal came out. And he was turned down. And everyone was baffled because this was a star officer. None of this stuff had come out yet. This guy was a rising star, narcotics and in crash. And the other department turned him down. And when the department LAPD called them and said, why? They said, well, we can't really tell you.
Of course.
But the speculation was that it was probably something in the polygraph or maybe in the psyche eval. But that department was smart. They had procedures in place to screen somebody out like Ray Perez, and he didn't go to that department.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Bill, and you're going to say something. The agency was smart, but it's likely that they were not letting their standards be bastardized by other motivations as well.
Exactly.
They may have, LAPD may have said things. You know what? Well, but you know what? The chief really wants XYZ in the department, or the department really wants this demographic increase. And this is where competition of priorities and principles, this is where we start falling into this trap. Instead of holding your ground, saying we're going to hire the best people we can, regardless of any other ancillary characteristics, this is the problem that we get into. And by the way, to some degree, I saw it over the years, the Highway Patrol, certainly not to this extent. And I always push back about those things. So it can happen to any organization. We all have to be careful. And we all have to fight political pressure about these things that really don't matter when it comes to law enforcement. What matters are principles, standards, and accountability.
So, Sean, in closing, where does the truth lie in this? Is it, and I got to, and obviously, I don't know if you can answer this the exact way I'm going to ask it, but is this a situation where there was, let's say, the Russell Poole theory, that there was more there, that LAPD perhaps didn't want, that Chief Parks didn't want to come to light, and it was swept under the rug? Or was this really just a small group of officers that really were running a criminal network, meaning, you know, Perez and his close confidants, Mack and Gaines? Right. What do you think the truth lies, or is it somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, it's definitely somewhere in the middle, but, you know, we ended up convicting several officers, convictions that stood, even aside from the ones that were found guilty by the jury and later overturned. So there was definitely a problem in Rampart Crash. On the other hand, Ray Perez can't be trusted for anything. So did Ray Perez embellish? Probably. Ray Perez is a consummate liar. But, you know, there were so many difficulties in investigating this case. One of them, for instance, I had a guy I was looking at, Ruben Palomares, who's a police officer in Crash. I couldn't get anyone to corroborate what Ray Perez told us about Palomares. I couldn't get gangsters to testify against him. They refused, even though he was a corrupt cop. Ruben Palomares ended up doing takeover robberies of cartel-related stash houses for cocaine and cash, and ended up getting sentenced to a lengthy prison sentence in federal court for that activity. Was Ruben Palomares dirty? Absolutely. I couldn't prove it as part of Rampart Crash, but he was a dirty cop. So the answer is somewhere in between. You know, you have a line cop who's trying to save himself. You have witnesses that have lengthy criminal records because they're the ones that they're picking as victims. But on the other hand, there's definitely some bad stuff that happened there, and there were some convictions as a result.
Got it. Chief Mark Garrett, thank you for being with us today. Sean Carney, always a pleasure. Thank you. Great insight on this issue. And thank you for joining us. Folks, leave a comment. Let us know where you stand on the whole thing after hearing the facts. A troubling time in the history of the city of L.A., but like both our guests said, hopefully we've come out on the better end of it, and the police department is better and the city's better. Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you soon.